I want to continue in volume 6, and this will be the final segment of this session, November the 17th, 1904. How the soul can be food for Jesus. Having received communion, I was thinking about the kindness of our Lord in giving himself as food to such a poor creature as I am, and about how I could correspond to such a great favour. While I was thinking of this, Blessed Jesus told me, "My daughter, just as I make myself food for the human creatures, so she can make herself my food, converting all of her interior into nourishment for me, in such a way that her thoughts, her affections, her desires, her inclinations, her heartbeats, her sighs, her love, everything should tend towards me. And I, on seeing the true fruit of my food," because he feeds us so that we will be able to live in union with him, which is to divinize the soul and convert everything within myself, would come to nourish myself with the soul, that is, with her thoughts, with her love, and with all the rest. In this way, the soul could say to me, "Just as you have reached the point of making yourself my food and giving me everything, I too have made myself your food. There's nothing left to give you because everything I am and everything I have is yours." Now, we sing that to the Lord and we make prayers of it. But the thing is, it has got to become a reality, not just words, that everything in us actually genuinely does belong to the Lord. So Louisa says, "In the meantime, I understood the enormous ingratitude of human beings, because while Jesus deigns to reach such excessive love as to make himself our food, we then deny him his food and cause him to remain on an empty stomach." November the 18th, 1904. This is a very important message. The heaven of Jesus on earth is the souls that give a dwelling to his divinity. So what makes Jesus happy and able to have a place to live on earth are souls who will live in the divine will. "As I was in my usual state," Louisa said, "my adorable Jesus came for just a little. And he told me, 'My daughter, when I come upon the earth, my heaven, when I came on the earth in the incarnation, my heaven was my humanity.'" Now, the humanity of Jesus contained the divinity as well. So that's why it was his heaven. "And just as in the heavens one can see the multitude of stars, the sun, the moon, the planets, the vastness, all placed in good order, in the same way, my humanity, which was my heaven, it was the image of the heavens that exist above us, in which everything is orderly. It was to make the order of the divinity dwelling inside shine forth, that is, virtues, power, grace, wisdom, and the like." So all the virtues are the stars, and the planet is our interior given to the Lord. "Now, when the heaven of my humanity ascended into heaven after my resurrection, my heaven upon the earth was to continue to exist." Because after all, he is risen from the dead. "And it is the souls who give a dwelling to my divinity." That's where he has his dwelling on earth. That's 1 Corinthians 3:16. "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that God dwells in you?" Also Luke 17:21. "Dwelling in them, I form my heaven, and from them also do I make the order of the virtues contained inside shine forth." So if the Lord is dwelling within us, the heavenly virtues will shine forth from us as well. "And you, would you not want to be my heaven? Tell me you would," Jesus says. And Louisa says, "Lord, I want nothing but to be recognized in your blood, in your wounds, in your humanity, in your virtues, In this alone I would want to be recognized so as to be your heaven, but to be unrecognized by all others. Jesus seemed to approve of my proposal and he disappeared. So here Jesus is saying that during the time of the incarnation, his humanity was the place where God was able to dwell on the earth. In other words, he was the Holy of Holies. And just like you see great order in all of God's creation, the order of God's being was shown in Jesus with all the virtues and the graces that were within him. And so he wants to dwell in us in his divine will so that the same thing can happen in a smaller measure. We're only tiny dots by comparison with him. November the 24th, 1904. In order to give and to receive, it takes union of wills, naturally. Being all afflicted and oppressed, and seeing good Jesus dripping blood, I said, "Blessed Lord, what about me? Don't you want to give me at least one drop of blood as remedy for all my evils?" And he said to me, "My daughter, in order to give, it takes the will of the one who must give and the will of the one who must receive." In other words, for a gift to pass from one to the other, there must be the willingness to give the gift and the willingness to receive it. Otherwise, if someone wants to give and the other does not want to receive, even though the first wants to give, he cannot give. Likewise, if the first one does not want to give, the other can't receive. It takes the union of two wills. Ah, how many times my grace is suffocated and my blood rejected and trampled upon. While he was saying this, I saw old people swarming inside the blood of sweet Jesus, and many would go out of it, not wanting to remain inside that blood in which all our goods and any remedy for our evils are enclosed. So all our redemption is contained in that blood. If we go away from it, we're simply completely mad, crazy, out of our minds. November the 29th, 1904. This is also a VIP message. The divinity of Jesus in his humanity descended into the deepest abyss of all human humiliations and divinized and sanctified all human acts. Now, this needs to be read 10 times over and meditated on. This morning I was offering all the actions of the humanity of our Lord, Louisa said, to repair so many of our human actions, either carelessly done without a supernatural purpose or sinful, in order to impetrate or intercede that all creatures might do their actions with the intentions of the actions of blessed Jesus and in union with them. Now, the only intention he accepts from us is love. He did everything for love. He is love incarnate. So Louise was praying that all of us might do our actions with the intentions of the actions of blessed Jesus and in union with them, and to fill the void of glory that human creatures would give to God if they did so. While I was doing this, she said, my adorable Jesus came. My daughter, he said, my divinity in my humanity descended into the deepest abyss of all human humiliations. I don't think we can understand. I don't think our minds can comprehend the depth of humiliation that Jesus actually suffered and what it was for someone who was divine to take such humiliations from his own creatures. I think it's beyond us to get that on board, but we need to try. So he said, my divinity in my humanity descended into the deepest abyss of all human humiliations, so much so that there was no human act, as lowly and little as it might be, which I did not divinize and sanctify. That's why it is so important for us to give him every act, every thought, every desire, every motion, everything, so that they will in fact be divinized. And this, he said, in order to give back to man doubled sovereignty, the one he lost in creation and the one I acquired for him in redemption. And man, always ungrateful and the enemy of himself, we even say that ourselves, that such and such a person is his own worst enemy. Man, who's always ungrateful and enemy of himself, loves to be a slave rather than a sovereign. That's John 8:44. Jesus says that anyone who sins is a slave, and that's just it. So all the enormous freedom and glory that the Lord offered to us in creation, and which of course was rejected in the fall, and we have to get back in redemption. All of that is just set aside if we just choose to be enslaved to ourselves or to anything else. By a means so easy, that is, with the intentions of his actions to mine, he could render his actions deserving of divine merit. Please underline that in green, white and gold. All you have to do is align your intentions with his, your love with his, your experiences with his. That's all. You have to align it with his and offer it to the Father with his intentions to have everything completely divinized. With a means so easy, that is, with the intentions of his actions united to mine, he could render his actions deserving of divine merit. But he wastes them and loses the device of king and sovereign over himself. Uses the privilege, we would say, rather than device, of being king and sovereign over himself. Having said this, he disappeared, and Louisa said, I found myself back to myself. So December the 3rd, 1904, the so-called mistakes that are in these writings, Louisa discusses it with Jesus. Continuing in my usual state, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself, cast to the ground before the sun, which of course is the divine will, whose rays penetrated through the whole of me inside and out, leaving me as though enchanted. After much time, tired of that position, I began to crawl on the ground, for I did not have the strength to get up and walk. Then after I struggled very much, a virgin came who took me by the hand and led me inside a room on a bed in which there was the baby Jesus placidly sleeping. Content for having found him, I placed myself near him, but without waking him up. After some time, he woke up and he began to stroll on the bed. And I, fearing that he might disappear, said, pretty little one of my heart, you know that you are my life. Please do not leave me. He said, let us establish how many times I must come. And Louisa said, my only good, what are you saying? Life is always necessary, therefore always, always. In the meantime, two priests came and the baby withdrew into the arms of one of them, commanding me to speak to the other. This one wanted an account of my writings and was reviewing them one by one. Fearing, I said to him, who knows how many mistakes are in there? And he, with affable seriousness, said, what mistakes? Against the Christian law? And Louisa said, no, grammar mistakes. And he said, well, that doesn't matter. Only theological mistakes would actually be something you'd have to be concerned about. So Louisa, gaining confidence, added, I fear that it may all be an illusion. And he, looking straight at me, replied, do you think I need to review your writings to know whether you are a deluded one or not? With two questions that I will ask you, I will know whether it is God or the devil who operates in you. First, do you think that you have deserved all the graces that God has given to you, or that they have been gift and grace from God? Louisa said, everything by the grace of God. Second, do you think that of all the graces that the Lord has given to you, your good will has anticipated grace, or that grace has anticipated you? And Louisa said, certainly grace has always anticipated me. Well, then he said, these answers make me understand that you are not deluded. And at that moment, Louisa came back to herself. So this was the reassurance that Jesus gave to Louisa, that her writings were fine. Now, when you go to the higher volumes, Jesus will say that everything in these writings is from himself. So December the 4th, 1904. It's easier to fight with God than with obedience. Louise, this is Louise's problem. As I was very agitated, Louisa said, and with the fear that blessed Jesus no longer wanted me in this state, I felt an interior strength to go out of it. And this strength I felt within me was so great that, unable to contain it, I kept repeating, "I feel tired, I cannot take any more." And in my interior, I heard being said to me, "I too feel tired. I can take no more. It's necessary that you remain completely suspended from the state of victim for a few days, so as to let them make the decision for wars." Now, the "them" here are the political powers that be, who are in the throes of making decisions about going to war. And then the voice said, "I will make you fall into this state again. Then when they do make the wars, we'll see what should be done with you." And Louisa said, "I didn't know what to do. Obedience didn't want it. And fighting with obedience is the same as surmounting a mountain that fills the earth and touches the heavens and without a path on which to walk. Therefore, it's insurmountable. I don't know whether this is foolishness, but I believe that it's easier to fight with God than this terrible virtue," she says, because Louisa is totally committed to obedience. And Jesus has told her that the same obedience that was in his life is to be in hers. So she says, "Agitated as I was, I found myself outside of myself in front of a crucifix. And I said, 'Lord, I can take no more. My nature has failed me. I lack the necessary strength to be able to continue in this state of victim. If you want me to continue, you have to give me the strength, otherwise I quit.'" Now, she's as clear as daylight with the Lord. "And while I was saying this, a fountain of blood gushed out from that crucifix towards heaven, and falling back over the earth, it converted into fire. Several virgins were saying, 'France, Italy, Austria, England, it's for them.' And they were mentioning other nations, but I didn't understand well. 'Most grave wars are prepared, civil and governmental.' On hearing this, I became all frightened," Louisa said, "and I found myself inside of myself. I myself could not decide what I should follow, whether the interior strength that pushed me to go out of this state of victim or the strength of obedience that pushed me to stay. Both of them were strong and powerful over my weak and poor being. So far, it seems that obedience prevails, though with difficulty, and I don't know where I will end up." So here she has been given the great warning about the First and Second World Wars. I'll give you Amos 3:7. "The Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. He always lets the ones who are close to him know what is coming, and therefore they can pray and they can intercede and make reparation. And they can also warn the rest of us." So notice the countries in Europe that were going to be central to the First and Second World Wars here. So the last text that I'm doing now, and then volume 6 is complete, is December the 6th, 1904. And it's about true death to self. "The beginning of eternal beatitude is to lose every taste for one's own." Okay, that's Matthew 5, verses 2 to 12. "As I continued struggling," Louisa said, "blessed Jesus came for just a little, and I saw myself as naked, stripped of everything. Perhaps a soul more miserable than I cannot be found. So extreme is my misery. What a dismal change. If the Lord does not make a new miracle of his omnipotence to make me rise again from this state, I will certainly die of misery." Then blessed Jesus told me, "My daughter, courage. The beginning of eternal beatitude is to lose every taste for one's own. Now, if you're to choose God's will, you have to let go of your own will. If you have to choose God's ways, you have to let go of your own ways. If you have to choose God's wisdom, you've got to let go of your own wisdom. And that's what they mean by losing the taste of one's own. In fact, as the soul keeps losing her own tastes, that's her ways of being and all the rest of it, the divine takes possession of her, and the soul, having undone and lost herself, no longer recognizes herself. She finds nothing else of her own, not even spiritual things. Now, there are people who are prepared to sacrifice material things, not at all willing to sacrifice spiritual things. There are people who think they are holy. They think they're close to God, but they wouldn't let go of their own opinion if you paid them. They wouldn't let go of things that they are completely dogmatic about. But you find that as you travel from the beginning to the end of the spiritual life, you've got to let go more and more and more and more. Let me give you an ordinary example. I was told about a meeting that took place in a school in Ireland. And this school took care of children from the beginning to the end of school life, so primary and secondary and kindergarten as well. And at one stage, the priests who were running this school decided that they would put all the parents together at one meeting to talk about rearing children. And the person who told me about it said she was utterly fascinated at what happened, that the parents who had children under the age of two were completely dogmatic about how children should be reared. And as you spoke to the parents with children who were 5 and 7 and 9 and 11 and 15 and so on, the higher you went in the child's age, the less dogmatic the parents were. And the parents of teenagers had nothing whatsoever to say about child rearing because everything they had ever believed had been challenged by their own children. And so as they went along in their parenting, they discovered they had to let go and let go and let go and learn completely new ways. It's exactly the same in the spiritual life. The people who are completely dogmatic about how to get close to God and how to pray and all the rest of it are at the beginning stages. The people who have most experience in the spiritual life are the silent ones who don't preach and who listen. Why? Because they've been challenged in absolutely everything they have ever believed. And they've had to let go, they've had to sacrifice, they've had to deny themselves. And very particularly opinions that they held on to very tightly, they had to let go of. So let's read this again now. My daughter, courage. The beginning of eternal beatitude or happiness is to lose every taste of one's own. That you've got to let go of everything. In fact, as the soul keeps losing her own taste, the divine taste take possession of her. And the soul, having undone and lost herself, no longer recognizes herself. She finds nothing else of her own, not even in spiritual things. Seeing that the soul has nothing else of her own, God fills her with all of himself and replenishes her with all of the divine happiness. So you let go of the human happinesses and the divine happiness moves in. You let go of the human satisfactions and the divine moves in. You let go of the human will and the divine moves in. Only then can the soul be truly called blessed, because as long as she has something of her own, she could not be exempt from bitterness and fears, nor could God communicate his happiness to her. No soul that enters the port of eternal beatitude can be exempted from this point. Please underline this in green, white and gold. This is extremely important. I'm going to read it again. No soul that enters the port of eternal beatitude, that means that enters heaven, can be exempted from this point. Painful, yes, but necessary. Nor can she do without it. Generally, they do it. That means they surrender, they let go. at the point of death, and purgatory does the rest. That's really sad, because it was not meant to be like that. Your purgatory should be on earth. And so when you come to the day of your death, everything has been surrendered, everything has been given. And so you go straight to heaven. Generally, people only make this surrender at the point of death, and purgatory does the last job. This is why, if creatures are asked what God's taste is, what divine beatitude is, these are things unknown to them because they've never tasted them. They couldn't articulate anything about it. But with the souls who are my beloved, since they have given themselves completely to me, I do not want their beatitude to have its beginning up there in heaven, but to have its beginning down here on earth. When Jesus proclaimed the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, he intended that to be here on the earth and as our foretaste of glory. I want to fill them not only with the happiness, with the glory of heaven, but I want to fill them with the goods, with the sufferings, with the virtues that my humanity had on earth. Therefore, I strip them not only of material tastes, which the soul nourishes, considers as dung, but also of spiritual tastes. We find that difficult to let go, in order to fill them completely with my goods and to give them the beginning of eternal beatitude. The Lord takes only what we can't take into heaven with us, and he gives us what we can only take into heaven with us. Therefore, not to allow him to give us the only baggage that is allowed on our journey to heaven is utter and complete foolishness. So at this stage, I have completely recorded volume 6, because the rest of the text is already recorded.